PIC and NetLife. So today we've got two items. The first one is the briefing by PIC and GEPF on the Steinhoff debacle. The second one is the briefing by NetLife on the transformation of the financial sector, because they were not there last week when we had a meeting. There's a third item, by the way, discussion on the proposed joint standard of on-matching requirements for non-centrally cleared over-the-counter derivative transactions. So those are the three items for today. The meeting is officially open. I've got three apologies. Honorable Zanel Nkomo, Honorable Floyd Chibambu, and Dr. George. Okay. And also Nkosi Buthelezi has apologized. Let's move to the first item, briefing by PIC and GEPF. We invited you today against the background of having met law enforcement agencies and Steinhoff in regard to the investment of PIC on Steinhoff. I will not go into detail as to what happened to Steinhoff. It's a matter of public knowledge. The reason why we called you is that this is the money of pensioners. Last year, when I was in the public service and administration, we met the unions, COSATO, SAFTU, PSA, in the main, I think it was those three federations. And they were very critical. So we have to be convinced as members of parliament that GEPF and PIC will recover the 20 billion rand or so from Steinhoff. And what are you doing legally to recover the money? Because there seemed to be no movement in regard to the agencies which are supposed to enforce the law. In the main, the Hawks and is it NPA? They were there in our last meeting at P249. We were not convinced about their presentation. And there should be no impression that you are moving at a slow pace or you are reluctant to recover the money. You have to convince Parliament today that you are very serious and these are the actions that you are taking to get the money back from Steinhoff. So that's the background against which we have invited you here. So the floor is yours. We'll start with the PIC and GEPF. We'll also have to present on this matter and then open the floor for questions and comments. PIC, you are welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair. We appreciate and welcome the opportunity to brief you on the sign-off issue. May I state at the outset that there is no reluctance for us to pursue that which we need to pursue on behalf of the pensioners, the widows, the orphans. We understand the duty that we have. We also want to submit that there is no sluggishness on our part. We have been active in pursuit of that. We came in as a team, and a few of us would actually be presenting. To my left is my deputy, Cindy Mabasokoyana, and to her left is the chairman of our investment committee, Temba Gameze. And to my right are the executives, led by acting chief executive, Vuyani Hako, who I would request to introduce the rest of the team, as well as lead the presentation to yourself. Once again, thank you very much for the opportunity to update you on what it is we are doing for the three groups that you have mentioned, essentially your pensioners, your widowers, your widows, and orphans. And I want to re-emphasize that we take our responsibility extremely seriously. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe just to follow up again on what the Chair has just said, and from our side as well as the executive, we take this matter very, very seriously, and I can say that with no shadow of any doubt. On my right-hand side, Chair, is Lindy Wetlamini, the Head of Legal Services, who is going to be taking us through the presentation. And I have my colleague Botsang Morobe and my colleague Horatius Maluleka. So we are going to be working together on this presentation. So Chair, you have already mentioned in the past we were here, we talked about the transaction background, we talked about what happened, and today we are going to go straight into the legal recovery process. And for that, I'm going to ask my colleague, Lindy Wetlamini, to take the committee through the legal recovery process. Thank you, Chair. Oh, Chair, I also forgot to mention that our client, the Government Employees Pension Fund, is here with us. So, and Fikile is here on behalf of the GPF, and my colleague, Dion Porter, from our Corporate Affairs and Communications Department. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. I will be taking you through the legal recovery process that the PIC has embarked on. The first slide I'll be dealing with is slide 21 of the presentation. In the slide, we highlighted the fact that the PIC has appointed Grant and Eisenhofer, a Dutch-based law firm, was appointed by the PIC as legal counsel in the class action lawsuit that the PIC brought against Steinhoff and its related parties. This petition was filed in the Amsterdam Court of Appeals Enterprise Chamber for an independent judicial inquiry into the irregularities at Steinhoff, its businesses, and its related parties, and any corporate governance failures. GNE also represents various institutional investors who have joined the class action, so the PIC is not the only party that has joined the action. During April 2019, Steinhoff publicly announced its intention to resolve the claims that had been filed against it by third parties and indicated that it was amenable to resolving such claims by way of a negotiated settlement discussion, which would be conducted through a mediation process. Now, in considering this process, the PIC wanted also to embark on a process that was expeditious and wanted to resolve the matter on behalf of the underlying clients and the pensioners. Having regard to the various litigation proceedings that had been instituted against Steinhoff, and further taking into account the state of affairs with Steinhoff and its creditors, GNE advised the PIC to postpone but not withdraw the petition in order for the PIC to meaningfully participate in the mediation proceedings. I think, Chair, at this point it's important to emphasize the fact that whilst we filed the petition, we have not withdrawn the petition, we have not moved away from that court process. It is simply, or it is temporarily put on hold to allow us to engage Steinhoff on a mediation process.
Ms. Lamin, you have a PowerPoint presentation, isn't it? With slides. Can you try to follow what is in the presentation so that we're able to follow you? Because if you just talk to the report, we are not from PIC, we don't understand all the logic. So if you can stick to what is in the PowerPoint presentation so that we're able to follow you. Thank you. You can proceed.
Apologies, Chair. The presentation that I am dealing with starts on page 21. Thank you, Chair. I'm at the bottom of page 21, Chair and committee members. On the 21st of May 2019, GNE filed the necessary papers with the Dutch courts to have the petition postponed. The Dutch court noted the petition had been suspended for a certain period in order to allow or enable GNE representing the PIC and other participants to the class action to participate in the settlement negotiations, and that GNE had not formally withdrawn the petition from the Dutch court. Chair, if we move to slide 22, which deals with the mediation process. The mediation process commenced on the 4th of July 2019 in Amsterdam and initially ran for a period of 3 days and was held under strict confidentiality undertakings between all affected parties. We were all required to sign confidentiality undertakings in order to ensure that the terms of the negotiations remain confidential pending the completion of the mediation. There are three key groups of creditors or claimants, being the bondholders, who have the strongest position because their rights are senior and they can pull the plug and place Steinhoff in bankruptcy for all the loans on which Steinhoff has defaulted. There are vendor claims of those who purchase and exchange Steinhoff stock as part of the many M&A transaction, and the last group of affected parties are the shareholders, which includes the PIC, who bring claims for prospectus liability or delict or secondary market security fraud. Chair, moving on to slide 23. During the mediation, Steinhoff had made a proposal to the participating investors or shareholders. This was intended to be paid by a third party by the name of the White Knight. The terms of the proposal remained confidential, as I've indicated, because we were compelled to sign non-disclosure agreements. And details of that settlement process are market sensitive and can constitute inside information. We've indicated in the presentation that the size of the number of parties involved, the fact that it's also multi-jurisdictional, the jurisdictions affected by this is South Africa, the Netherlands, and Germany, make this process very complex and time-consuming. But we've highlighted that the key to finding a solution to this problem is that Steinhoff will have to sell certain assets. There's a maximum to what Steinhoff can sell as a condition of the agreement with the bondholders. Chair, if we move on to slide 24, we've indicated the probabilities of a liquidation scenario. If the mediation process falls apart and Steinhoff accordingly fails to reach a settlement with the participating shareholders, it increases the chance of the company's failure. There is, however, an existing standstill agreement that was entered into between Steinhoff and his creditors, which protects Steinhoff from bankruptcy for a period of 3 years. The standstill agreement gives Steinhoff time to work out things with its shareholders, and I think that information was publicly shared by Steinhoff. Chair, we've also indicated that over and above the court process that the PIC has lodged against the Steinhoff in the Dutch court and the mediation process that we are considering, we've also been engaged by the law enforcement authorities. We've received confirmation from law enforcement agencies that they are investigating those implicated in the Steinhoff matter. The PIC has been approached by law enforcement agencies to assist, and the PIC is providing them with the assistance that is required and all the information that is required to finalize that process. One of the other things that the PIC has considered is possible action against directors of Steinhoff. The PIC has contemplated further steps it can possibly take against those implicated in the Steinhoff matter. In fact, we are not contemplating. We have briefed external counsel and a senior counsel on the matter. The PIC also noted the action that was taken by the regulator, the FSCA, who levied a fine against Steinhoff of $1.5 billion for misrepresenting its finances to the market. We understand that Steinhoff will only need to pay $53 million of the fine, but PIC is in the process of instituting legal proceedings against the directors implicated in the financial irregularities of the company. One of the other things that we have finalized on our side as the PIC is, which we deem to be critical, is the PwC report. It's not included in the presentation, Chip. I just received confirmation. The PIC is in the process of filing its application to compel the disclosure of the PwC report. As I've indicated, Chair, the papers have been finalized, and the PIC has indicated on no uncertain terms that access to that report becomes critical for the PIC to understand what really happened at Steinhoff. Chair, in conclusion, the mediation process remains ongoing. As and when we receive developments, we are reporting regularly to our clients and our affected stakeholders, but the PIC Chair is taking the necessary action against those that are implicated in the Steinhoff debacle. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Koza, the chairperson, and board members, acting CEO, and the head of legal. Members, that's the presentation from PIC. Clarity, seeking questions, comments. I will answer. Honorable Mshala. Those are the two hands that we have. Honorable Abrams. Pardon? Okay.
Can we question them now on the full presentation? Or is someone else going to present still?
Are you not done with presentation?
We're done with the presentation. Okay. So, as you indicated earlier on, we were to present on the legal recovery process.
Yeah, after them, we'll take GEPF. Honorable Lewis.
No, I
want
to be on the list.
Okay, Honorable Lewis. Okay. Honorable Mavila, first.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask if the leadership of the PIC really is politically conscious in terms of social democracy and developmental state goals. And, you know, because this money belongs to the people. So I'm not encouraged. Your last statement is say the mediation remains ongoing. It simply means there are no time frames. Because ongoing, we can go on, push with us 5 years this year, we are gone, and it's still ongoing. What we need is time frames. At least if you tie everything within the time frame, we are able to follow up. But this ongoing, I don't agree with it. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Marinette. Honorable Rebecca Mshan.
Thanks so much, Chair. This wrongdoings I don't think they happened overnight. It's a process which took maybe some years. I want to check with you, was there no way to detect all these irregularities? Because I don't think that 20 billion was just like gone just overnight and we did not know. So I want to check if there was no way to detect the irregularities. And the other thing is, there is what we call audit report. You did not do your, there was no terms of reference before you can invest the money into Steynhof. You never check what is the state of their organ of Steynhof in particular. Then number two, I want to ask, because we need to start, I think, fast-tracking the process of consequence management. I see here you have mentioned that the investigations are underway in order to ensure that those people are brought to book. So let's ensure that we fast-track the process. We cannot just make things simple as they are. Just leave the perpetrators, because I know in government it happens. Most of the people do as they wish, and one, two, three, they are no, there's nothing happening against them. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams.
Thanks, Chair. I think, Chair, we need to thank the presentation by PIC and also appreciate what is being done so far. But Chair, I think the fact that somebody with a name has committed a crime, and now what we're getting as feedback is just Steynhof. And I think things must have moved in terms of the interaction between the PIC and law enforcement agencies to a point where we can now comfortably say that these names have been taken in to account. Is there no such progress that can ease the pain that's felt out there? And I think my next question relates to both honorable members, Mabiletsa and Rebecca, because my first question really was around the issue of time frame. I know that to a certain extent this might not depend on PIC, but I think also for PIC as well, it might be a bit strenuous to deal with this singular issue over a long period of time. So I think let us be given some comfort by an indication of what the time frames are. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Hildewis.
Thank you. Just before I ask my questions, I would like to, if I may, Chair, just get clarity on one thing that will affect my later questions. The size of the loss as we speak. You've got a slide here on 9 quantifying the 11.5 billion rand loan, which is basically, well, it currently has very little prospect of being repaid. So you've got a loss there. And then on page 17, as I understand it, this was your normal listed exposure to Steynhof outside of the loan, and this loss is 18.7, say. So am I correct in understanding, just before I ask my questions, that your total unrealized loss is around 28 billion, including the loan and your normal listed position? Is that correct? Can I just get a nod or a wink?
So the correct number, you've written off 100% of the loan. There's a recoverable of about 5.5 there.
Okay, we'll give you time to respond. He's just asking questions. So if you are done, you let me know that you are done so that I can open the floor for them. I think they've got a protocol that they follow. We'll start to respond and we'll be the last. So are you done, Honorable Lewis? Okay, proceed. Why should it? You want to get a clarity as to whether it's 28 billion rand that has been lost?
That's what I'm asking before my other questions.
I think ask all the questions, they will respond, including that one, whether it's 28 billion or it's so much. They will have to follow all the, the sequence in the manner that you will have asked the questions. So in their responding, they will have to respond to all your questions. You can proceed.
Okay, thank you very much. So I interpret it as a total unrealized loss of 28 billion rand if I write off 100% of the loan as unrecoverable. So then you can let me know if that's correct or not. Also, I would just point out that your current financial position is based on the share price in February. The share price now is less than half of that, 98 cents today. So this loss is effectively under-reported. There's another 1 rand 8 cents per share that you must write off there, please. Okay, then what really interests me about this is how this deal came about. And I'd like to ask if you could just set out in detail how it is that one person, Mr. Naidu, Jayendra Naidu, gets a 9.35 billion rand loan from the PIC. Out of all of the possible beneficiaries in South Africa, the many, many millions of people, the thousands of people that worked in Steinhoff businesses that could have been beneficiaries, my understanding, certainly your presentation, is that Mr. Naidu is 100% owner of Lancaster. So I'm really interested to know what the genesis of this deal was. It sounds like, more than winning the lotto. It's just unbelievable. If you could set out how it is that he was selected as the partner for this loan by the PIC. Then what action is, you've set out what action you're taking against Steinhoff and Mr. Uster and other directors. What action are you taking against Mr. Naidu? He's also not a bystander in this whole thing. You did the deal with him, and as I understand it, he is the owner of the share in Steinhoff, not the PIC. You've got the option. You've got the collateral. I understand that, but ultimately your claim is against Lancaster for that deal, not against Steinhoff. So what action is being taken against Mr. Naidu? Then if you could just say, is Steinhoff's current management team being entirely cooperative, playing open cards with the PIC, and if not, what are the details? And then you say that you are applying for delinquency against a number of Steinhoff directors. Could you please name which Steinhoff directors you're applying for delinquency against? Thank you.
Thanks. Let's go to slide 23. Bullet point 2. While Steinhoff has made efforts to reach a settlement, it must be noted that this process is fragile and could perhaps not come to fruition, or the details thereof will change at any moment. The sheer size of the number of parties involved the fact that it is multi-jurisdictional, South Africa, the Netherlands, Germany, all make this process very complex and time-consuming. What do you mean by this? That's time-consuming, so it's not necessary. What can you explain in simple terms? If you say the process is very complex and time-consuming, because it's consuming time, you want to abandon the process. Because words have to be interpreted properly. We have got international treaties and conventions with all these countries that you have mentioned here. Why should it be a problem when we have to talk to our counterparts in Germany, the Netherlands, and here in South Africa? Where's the problem? Recently, there was a case of a former Mozambique finance minister. There was a procedure in the manner how it was dealt with. It was Mozambique, South Africa, and America. But we don't understand what you mean when you say it's too complex. We have got Interpol, we have got so many treaties and conventions that we have signed with EU and respective countries. Because the pensioners are worried. Somebody has got a house at the beach in Hermanus enjoying life when their money has disappeared and there seems to be no prospect of that money being recovered. So you are coining the manner that you put your statements here. It's like this is a waste of time. You have to explain to us what you mean by time-consuming and multi-jurisdictional, so this is complex. It can't be. We are part of the global governance system. We are in all global multilateral bodies. So we don't understand why do you make this kind of a statement. Respond to all the questions that have been asked. And I'm not sure we'll start and we'll end. You will follow your protocol from your side. The time is yours now. The stage is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair. We are going to start from the first question. So the first question was around the mediation process and the concern around the time frames. When is it going to end? Earlier on, my colleague, when we were presenting, indicated that we are in a legal process, but the legal process has been suspended to make way for the mediation. Now, the mediation was intended to look into the prospects of a commercial agreement. So, intentions being to see if we can save as much money as quickly as possible. So, but the mediation process is not open-ended, and the last date for that mediation process is actually the end of December 2019. So it has a time frame. So if it does not yield any results, we go back to the full steam legal process. So that was question number one. And then the second question was around the, you know, do we have mechanisms to detect these things? Are we able to see them before they happen? So, and the answer to that, Chair, is that within the PIC, yes, we have ways of monitoring the performance of portfolios. So, and the key to a lot of these companies is that you have to place reliance on what the auditors are telling you. And Steinhoff is also that case in point. They had auditors, so which are highly recognized by the market, so and the executive management team. So, and for us in terms of monitoring, we actually relied on that report. So, but my colleague later on, Lindy, will expand on that, because we're not letting the auditors off the hook. we are doing something to say to the auditors, look, you've let us down the garden path. So the third question was also around the time frames. So, and I think I've covered that. There was a concern around the mediation process, which is open-ended, and the time frame is end of December. There was a question which I'm going to ask my colleague Horatius to answer around the 9.3 billion. How was this deal originated? So, and what action is being taken against Mr. J. Naidu? I am going to request my colleague Horatius to help with that question.
I think the CEO has covered me in terms of time frames, and I think the assurance that we can give the committee is that we have received an offer from Steinhoff, which we are interrogating as the PIC. This was as recent as last week. We are applying our minds to that process, and to the extent that the PIC, through its internal governance processes, is comfortable with what is being presented to them, we will then obviously report back on finalization of that process. Progress regarding the issue of the law enforcement agencies. The undertaking that we've given the law enforcement agencies is that we will provide them with all the relevant or all the necessary information to assist them with their process against the affected directors. That process, I can safely say, is at quite an advanced stage. The PIC is finalizing its submission to the law enforcement agencies, and this cuts across to not just the Hawks, but any other regulator that approaches the PIC for assistance. We have engaged multiple regulators in this regard to basically make sure that a proper consequence management and full consequence management is adhered to. The other question was pertaining to the names of the directors. As I've indicated that the PIT is in the process of finalizing its papers for delinquency processes, what council has advised us is that we can only formulate a proper view regarding the way forward regarding the delinquency of those directors if we have access to proper information, and that includes the PwC report. We've written a letter of demand to Steinhoff with indicating that we wanted access to the report. They have failed to provide us with that report. Subsequent to that, we have finalized our papers to compel the disclosure of the PwC report, which will assist us greatly in identifying those that are responsible for the malfeasance at Steinhoff and those that we can pursue from a delinquency process. If I can perhaps just explain the wording, and perhaps it was not intended to minimize or downplay the importance of the action that we are trying to take against Steinhoff. I think what we try to indicate here is that given the number of institutional investors and affected parties that are claiming in this process, the mediation process is naturally taking quite a bit of a long time. I mean, we started this process in July and we are targeting a date of December. We have on no uncertain terms indicated to Steinhoff that failure of Steinhoff to come to the party and put their best foot forward and give us a palatable offer that the PIC can take back to its underlying clients, we are going to reactivate the litigation that we instituted. I think we have been firm in that regard. And Steinhoff understands fully the PIC's position, and this is a position that we've indicated to our clients, being the UIF and the GPF, that to the extent that Steinhoff fails to come to the party, we are simply going to reactivate the litigation. The reason why we embarked on the mediation process really was to find an expeditious way to settle this claim that the PIC has put forward to Steinhoff. So we are trying by all means, and we are looking at all avenues to recover this money. And our Chair, you are quite correct. We are engaging with all the relevant stakeholders in this regard, both locally and internationally, to assist us with ensuring that there's traction on the matter. I'll hand over to Horatius regarding the balance of the questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to the esteemed committee members. The first question that we're going to address now is how was the transaction originated? From an origination perspective, we were approached by Jayendra Naidu alongside Steinhoff, effectively at the time, with the opportunity to buy into the voting pool shares as well as an additional chunk of shares that were going to give us empowerment credentials into the transaction, which then leads into the next part of the question, why Jayendra Naidu? So the first part is it was an approach by both Jayendra Naidu as well as the Steinhoff Group with the intention to do an empowerment transaction. Through the approval process, actually, the shareholding into the structure was changed significantly. From a shareholding perspective, the PIC owns 50% of the shares that are sitting in the Lancaster Group. Jayendra Naidu owns 25%, and a broad, well, not quite a broad base, it is a, it's a non-profit company owns the other 25%. So the non-profit company non-profit company effectively owns the other 25%, and does a handful of, empowerment initiatives, which includes entrepreneurial development into the furniture space, where those people can then supply into the JD Group, as well as education trust, I think, from what I understand, and healthcare as well. So there is, it's not just Jayendra Naidu into there. Then the other part of the question was, to answer your question a bit more directly as well, because we own 50%, he's not 100% controlling that particular vehicle, we actually have a claim to that as well. And then your other question was around the size of the loss and the date. So what we had published for you there was the last number that we'd had from a annual results perspective. What we do have now is that number goes up to an additional 200 million loss. So it goes to about, actually no, it goes down by about 800 million, sorry, my mistake. Directionally, the loss goes to 600. So the billion goes up to the loss goes up to 6.2 billion on the Lancaster transaction. So from a corporation perspective, current management and the current Steinhoff board have actually been quite available to us. We've had the opportunity to engage them. We do have to be cognizant of the fact that this is, it remains a publicly listed entity, and we don't want to fall foul of insider regulations. And the two processes between the mediation as well as our investment process have to at all times be separated such that we don't fall foul of insider trading rules. But from an access perspective, we do have access to the management team.
Are you done with responses, or so that I can check with members if there are follow-up questions?
Thank you, Chair. I think we are done, but there is one last question which we need to deal with. The question about whether we are taking action against Mr. J. Naidu. So, and that question put differently, is the loan in default? And therefore, what are you doing if it is in default? My colleague, Lindy Way and Horatius, will help.
Thank you, Chair. At the current moment, the loan is not in default. So the Lancaster structure Lancaster 101 and 102 is not underwater. So there is no direct approach, or we're not going after Jayendra because the loan is not in default.
But just to add on to that, part, as Horatius indicated, part of the settlement negotiation that we are discussing with Steinhoff includes our Lancaster exposure. So that has been factored into the mediation process, the unrealized loss that we have suffered under the Lancaster 101 and 102 exposure has been factored into the mediation process.
Chair, I think one last question which we may have missed is the names of the directors that are affected. So I'm getting a note that we have not answered that question, but I think my colleague Lindy will try to explain that. But maybe again, Lindy, you can explain that.
So, Chair, as we've indicated, one of the important things for us to take any form of action against the directors of Steinhoff is to make sure that we have all the relevant information to make sure that by the time we institute proceedings against the directors of Steinhoff, we have the full background and the full picture of what happened. And through our engagement with counsel, one of the biggest issue for us is disclosure of this PwC report. The PwC report becomes critical and integral in us understanding what exactly happened at Steinhoff and who's responsible for what. So I think having access to that report will enable us to take the action that we need to take. And as I've indicated, we did issue a letter of demand to Steinhoff about 2 weeks ago requesting this report, failure of which we are in the process of launching our application to compel Steinhoff to release that report.
Thank you, Chair. We are done.
Okay. Follow-up questions, Honourable. Okay.
My deputy would like to elaborate on one or two things before we conclude that.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Chair and the members. I guess the PwC report matter needs to be given a little bit of colour because even in the audit committee and later the board, the issue that bothered us as the board was why it was so difficult to get into this report and why can't we do our own investigation. So those are the two questions. Number one, what became very clear is that it took PwC 18 months to actually delve into the detail of this fraud, which meant that this is not a simple exercise and it was complex looking at the manner in which the fraud was actually perpetuated. And there was also a very ridiculous amount that PwC was paid for this report. I'm not sure if Vianney remembers that amount. So that was one reason. And the board indicated to the team that while PwC has confidentiality responsibilities to its clients, it doesn't mean that given how much this matter is of public nature, we can be denied access to this report. Hence, the team are now following the legal route because through a demand via court, PwC will actually be expected and required to actually make this report available. I mean, the audit firms will usually have that clause that says it's a confidential report which is only given to the client. However, under legal and from law enforcement agencies, they will make the report available. In this case, we are now following that route because we did find it a bit actually mischievous for Steinhoff to be holding back this report if indeed they feel they want to correct and come to the party. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Follow-up questions, Honorable Lewis.
Yeah, noted, Honorable Lewis, Honorable Rebecca Lennon. Honorable Abrams, are you raising your hand? Okay, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Lewis.
Thank you very much. I'm still interested in the structure of the deal. So, Mr. J. Naidu, alongside Steinhoff, approaches the PIC and gets a 9.35 billion rand loan. It just seems too easy and too extraordinary to me. I mean, this is not someone that has enormous financial firepower, like, for example, the former chairman of Steinhoff. I would wager that even Dr. Causa, in his previous life before the PIC, would struggle to obtain such a loan from the PIC, even as eminent a business person as he is, would struggle to get a 9.5 billion rand loan, just like that. So, I'm not sure that I accept the explanation that the approach was made alongside Steinhoff, and this made such obvious business sense that one person was selected for such an unbelievably enormous loan. So let me just ask a direct question. Who in particular, when you say that you were approached by Mr. Naidu and Steinhoff, who from Steinhoff approached you from alongside Mr. Naidu? I would like to know some more detail about that. Then I do just want to point out, I accept your explanation around the quantifying the size of the loss, and note that it is actually 1.2 billion rand bigger than you indicate here. But also just to say that you were overweight Steinhoff at the time, because if you look here, it was about 3.3% of benchmark, and you had 3.3% in your listed portfolio. But that excludes this loan. So you've got to add another 10 billion onto that, and that does put you significantly over benchmark on Steinhoff. So again, I don't see how it made sense. It was beyond what the benchmark suggested you should have been in Steinhoff at the time. And that goes to the question asked by my colleague from the EFF. I think it was you, ma'am, that asked about foresight of these issues. And obviously the loss would have been more limited had you stuck to the benchmark for your overall exposure, which you were not. Where can we get details of this non-profit company? If you could provide us with some more details of what it does. I must say that I think the structure, even, I take your argument, sir, that the structure was improved after the PIC got involved, but it was still incredibly concentrated, making Mr. Naidu effectively a 25% owner of these shares, one individual. Whereas all this so-called broad-based aspect, this trust, doesn't make any profit. So they don't get any of the upside on the investment. It's a non-profit trust. But Mr. Naidu gets all of the upside. This is exactly the kind of concentrated example of BEE enrichment that makes people sick, frankly. Then I'm interested in the statement that the loan is not in default. Could you just give us some more detail about what the terms of the loan were and how, frankly, it's been serviced? I mean, even if there's a very generous 5.5%, or maybe let's say 5% rate on that loan, what is that? That's 450, let's say, rounding off in my head, 450 million rand a year that must get serviced on that loan. The shares are deep, deep underwater, as we know. How is that loan being serviced? How is it not in default? Thank you.
Thanks. Honorable Mshlan.
No, thanks so much, Chair. I think we're still going to face problems going forward, same as this one of Steinhoff. So my question is, in terms of the delegation of authority, who takes decision? Is it an individual or the PIC as a committee who takes decisions. Because it's not for the first time something like this happened. It happened previously with the Mayo or IO technology solution, whereby, I've got it here. Sorry, Chair. I mean, it happens before with the IO investment solution, whereby a decision was taken to invest before a solution of listing it in of listing the IO technology solution. That's why I'm saying it's not for the first time. Now we are stuck with staying off. It happens before in 2017. We are still going to have problems going forward. So my question is, who's taking this decision in terms of investing? Is it the committee itself, or is a person, an individual, sitting somewhere and taking all these decisions? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams.
It's not really a question, but it's a comment that one would love the comment of the PAC on. The documents that are in front of us that we've been dealing with since the fifth term indicate to us that people who have benefited are people of color, and people who are now accounting here are not. Is that by design or default? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. Can respond to questions? PIC.
Chair, the first question is from Honorable Lewis. It's around the structure of the deal. And he wants to know in particular who approached the PIC from Steinhoff alongside Mr. Naidu. I think that was the question. And the second question was, what is the statement of the loan? How is it being serviced? I think those were the questions. And then the third question was details of the non-profit company. Can I request my colleague, Horatio Sembotsang, to help?
Thank you very much on that, CEO and committee. In terms of the approach, we understood that there was support from Steinhoff, and that was implicit by the fact that they were buying shares from a voting pool set of shares from a Steinhoff perspective. So I do not recall, and I'm not aware that anyone specifically came alongside, but because the pool of shares were coming from existing Steinhoff shareholders that are part of a voting pool, that was the tacit sort of approach alongside Steinhoff. That's what we mean.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I should take the second question on the default. So in terms of the Steinhoff transaction, there were actually two transactions that happened back to back. The initial transaction was the loan from PIC to Lancaster to buy the equity in Steinhoff. The terms of that loan was a five-year term. I think the interest might have been reference rate R208 plus 200 bits. Subsequent to that transaction, the Steinhoff share price began to tank, which led us to actually do a transaction that would then enhance our security package, because initially the security package included the Steinhoff shares. The second transaction then involved the Lancaster 101 obtaining a loan from Citibank, and with that loan they bought Pepco shares. Now, what has happened over the years is the initial structure was just Steinhoff shares. The dividends was meant to actually pay out or pay down some of the interest accumulating or accruing to the PIC. When the share price went down, obviously there was a significant gap between what they could eventually pay and what the interest was to us. But now with the new structure that involved Pepco shares are not, you know, they're doing far much better than Stanhope shares. There's a bit of serviceability that's coming from the dividends there. So that's how we've managed to get some of our loans serviced. But you're quite correct. From the inception, the dividend yield was never intended to be enough to actually cover the interest. It was anticipated that at a later stage, 3-5 years along the line, there would be some exit mechanism that would ensure that there was upside participation for the BEE and the PIC.
Was it Honorable Betha? The representative from EFF who wanted to know who took the decisions. Clearly, there were, I think there were faults in terms of checks and balances. The major fault there was the collapsing of the chief executive officer's position and the chief investment officer's position collapsed into one. And there was one individual who loomed a little too large in those decision the processes. One of the things that we actually have to regularize as a new board is to make sure that there are checks and balances. The chief investment officer will not be the same person as the chief executive officer. And the committee that deals with investments, currently chaired now by Mr. Gamedze, would actually make sure that it is actually involved in the decision-making process to a much deeper and greater extent. Mr. Gamedze might want to comment a little on that. That is being corrected and regularized.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Temba Gamedze. Yes, there are a number of issues which are being currently the subject of the Mbati Commission, which will be submitting its report to the President, and presumably after that we will have some indication about some of the recommendations that are going to be made. But we as the interim board, obviously one of the first things that we have done is to reconsider all the processes, particularly the investment process. And I think the issues that have been raised now about delegations of authority are actually central to the operations of the PIC. So in respect of the committees which are involved and the delegations, how much people can invest without referring to a higher authority. So in the past, definitely some of these delegations were out of kilter to the extent that what would normally be regarded as a very high delegation was regarded as normal at the PIC. So certain structures had perhaps more authority than would have been appropriate. Those are all being changed as we speak. We are changing all those delegations. We are changing terms of references of the structures. And we're changing processes because all of them came about in the collapsing of the investment process from the rest of the corporation. A lot of changes were made in terms of the delegations of authority, and we're now making sure that those anomalies are regularized. So the issue is very much exercising the minds of this committee because at least we should make sure that the people who do the investments are not the same people who may have been asked about investments. So we would expect the CEO to be in touch with everybody. Everyone will want to talk to the CEO. So someone might suggest to the CEO that there's a transaction which he thinks is a good idea, or she. And then the CEO can say, wow, that looks great. Refer it to the investment process, I have nothing to do with that. And that was missing in the old regime, and I believe that was a major governance failure, which we hope will be corrected going forward.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, Chair, I think I'm going to seek clarity on the last question. I didn't quite get the question about people of color and who is here to account. With your permission, Chair, can I get clarity on that question?
Okay. No problems. Seemingly they don't understand the question very well. Maybe you can restate your question.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe as I do that, let me also accompany it with a question about Lancaster, whether the beneficiary is only this Mr. Naidu, or if there are any other beneficiaries. And I ask this question to make clearer the question I asked initially as to whether the people, the beneficiaries from Steenhof are black or white, maybe let me put it in black and white, or in between. And the fact that the people sitting before us from PIC are predominantly black, I was asking whether that's a default or design. And maybe lastly, Chair, it's an opportunity of also to ask about the report, whether it is now available and can be accessed, or whether it is still with PwC. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague is going to help with the difficult question. So I will deal with the question on PwC. We still do not have the report on PwC. So in the first instance, we wrote to Peter Steinhoff requesting access to the report, but we have not been successful in that, and hence we are now embarking on a legal process to try and force them to make that report available. So to answer the question, Chair, we still do not have the report. My colleague, Horatius, who can help me on the balance of the question.
Butang will help and Horatius can come in, Chair. I'll attempt to actually answer the question around the beneficiaries of the transaction. So I think earlier my colleagues had mentioned that the structure was such that the PIC GPS held 50% of the SPV. Jayendra Naidu actually held 25%, and there was a non-profit company that held the other 25%. Now, the beneficiaries of that non-profit company is black South Africans, black entrepreneurs, and black youth. The objectives of the objective of the NCP, or the non-profit company, NPC, is to actually provide loans to young entrepreneurs, groom them such that they are able to play into the bigger Steinhoff group. So, for example, you have Lancaster Group or Lancaster Foundation providing working capital to ABC for a small furniture shop. Carpenters, they then create some furniture, which then they then feed into JD, which is a Steinhoff Group company. So essentially, that foundation was meant to actually provide aid to youth, aid to young black entrepreneurs, and provide or use Steinhoff as an offtake to those products. So that is really that broad-based element that we try to incorporate into the transaction. Thank you, Chair.
Ed, the principles that Botsang is alluding to were all contracted with Lancaster in the form of a performance agreement where we outlined the objectives from an enterprise development, a supply development, but also, you know, what she indicated regarding developing black youth in this particular sector. They were all contracted in the form of a performance agreement with certain KDIs and punitive measures for non-compliance with those deliverables. Thank you, Chair.
I think that essentially brings us to the end, but I just wanted to re-emphasize your comments about the need for us to access international treaties and making sure that whatever happens, we are actually making common cause with those that may also be owed from elsewhere in the world. We are actually pursuing that. There is class action, which effectively says we work in common purpose with other creditors to sign off. We are not oblivious of the need to actually cooperate internationally.
Okay, last one. Okay.
It's just a clarity-seeking question, Chair, with regard to Adrian Lepay, because the CEO is here. He's a spokesperson of, he was once a spokesperson of Minister Pravin Gordhan, but he was still in the payroll of PIC. Was that matter solved, or how did that happen? Just give us a clarity. Thank you.
Honorable Louis, the last question so that we can get GPF, so that we are able to finish the meeting at 1 and allow members to prepare for, we are going to have a long session this afternoon in the plenary. Honorable Louis.
Yeah, just I understand, ma'am, thank you for the explanation and the rates. I understand that the interest is capitalized against the loan, and so it's, you know, there's currently about 2.5 billion rand in interest owed, and so technically I can understand how you can explain that that's not in default, but with the share price at 98 cents, I don't see how there's any exit for the PIC in 2 years time when the loan is due that sees that loan being honored. So I struggle with the idea that this loan is not in default and therefore there's no action against Mr. Naidu and Lancaster Group. I must just say I do struggle to get my head around that. And then if I can just ask you, was the Sierra and Blue Buck, those two deals, were those approved by the GEPF? Is there a kind of approval mechanism with the client for such major loans?
Thank you, Chair. So I'll answer your last question first. At the time when the transaction was done, our approval processes were such that the IC could actually approve this transaction. Currently, the threshold has been reduced. If this transaction was to be done now, we would then need to go to the GPF for approval. But at the time, that was not the case. I think when I make, when I address your question previously, I was talking from a place of technical default. And as it is, there is no technical default. We have some sort of a view that you might have that in 2 years we may be in a position of technical default. At this current juncture, we are looking at ways to actually restructure the transaction, which I might not be able to disclose the nitty-gritty, but we are actually looking at a way to minimalize, you know, losses to the GPF, if I may put it that way.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe just to add, as it relates to Blue Buck, There was no additional capital that was deployed or injected by the PIC as it relates to that transaction. So that transaction was approved within the internal governance structures of the PIC.
Thank you, Chair. I will take the question on Adrian Lackey. Adrian Lackey is an employee of the PIC. However, at some stage, he was seconded to the office of the minister for a period up to July this year. So, and that secondment arrangement has come to an end. So immediately after July, then Adrian Lackey came back to the PIC. He is now at the PIC.
Okay. Thanks, PIC. We'll make follow-up on the issues that you have raised. Parliament has got interest on a PwC report. Yes, because there's public money that has been lost here. And Steinhoff is playing hide-and-seek. If there's a PwC report, but they don't want PIC to access it, what are they displaying? You have invested a lot of money in Steinhoff. Here is an audit report, but Steinhoff tells you stories. We don't accept that. Because it's a problem. Every time they come here to the portfolio committee, I mean joint committee, you can't understand what they're saying. You can't. So we'll have to get this report. If we have to summon them, even as Parliament, we'll do so. We can subpoena them. Parliament has got powers within the jurisdiction of South Africa to subpoena any citizen or corporate to come and account. We equally, as Parliament, need to see that report so that the public should know what has happened. What is disturbing to the public and the beneficiaries is the posture of Steinhoff and the former employees, in particular Mr. Marcus Joster. To them it's like there's nothing wrong that they've done. So maybe you were not there in the last interaction. When you meet them, they don't even show remorse. There's nothing wrong. They are entitled. What they do, they bring an army of lawyers. And when you ask the questions, we are not sure. They use only three words until the end of the meeting. So it is completely unacceptable. And if Steinhoff is beginning to play this kind of a game where they don't want PwC report to be published, we'll take them head on as Parliament. Yes. It's quite unacceptable. So thanks very much for the presentation and the fielding of the questions. Let's move to GPF. It was a joint presentation, or GPF has got its own presentation.
Okay. We don't have a separate presentation. We have a mandate with the PIC, and PIC have provided the presentation and are in the best position to provide information on Steinhoff.
You said, what did you say about Steinhoff, madam? I didn't understand. Just take your time, relax, and explain in simple terms what do you mean by this one presentation. Then you said something about Steinhoff.
Okay, it's a joint presentation. I was referring to the fact that the GPF has a mandate with the PIC. And PIC, as our asset manager, are in the best position to provide information on Steinhoff.
Okay. So there's an agreement between PIC and GPF in regard to PIC investing money on behalf of GPF. Do we have such an agreement or contract, or what nature of contracts or agreement are those?
The mandate, Chair.
Then in simple terms, well, some of us are not lawyers. Well, what do you mean by a mandate?
Maybe, Chair, I can help with your permission. So when we received this request, so that the GPF and the PIC must come to present on Steinhoff, and then GPF said it to us, because you are an asset manager, can you put together the presentation which we will look at and be happy with, and then when we go there, you present it. However, if there are questions that pertain to GPF specifically, then we will take those. So that was the arrangement. So currently, the position is that PIC is the asset manager and the GEPF is the client. So PIC is an asset manager, therefore invests money on behalf of the client, which is GEPF. So which is why they said to us, then you need to go and account on how you have invested the money. But we'll go there with you, and then in case there are questions, to ask directly. Now, that arrangement is regulated in terms of FSCA by a mandate. So in simple terms, you can call the mandate, it's an investment agreement. So it is in place. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Mshala, who else wants to make a follow-up question? Honorable Abrahams Mavileta, Louis, Honorable Skosana, Honorable Mshala.
Chair, I just want to say that the GPF as a client of PIC, they must have their own opinion. What are you saying? What is your opinion in all this saga? Or what is that? Just say something to us. What can you say to us? Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Abram?
I'm covered, Chair. I would have asked the same question as to whether the GPF is happy with what is happening with PIC and what is their view.
Okay. Honorable Mavileta.
Because when they said you were coming, I read and I prepared, you know, two questions. Actually, it's a lot of questions, but I'll stick to two. And the first one is the fund invested in developing marginalized African majority in terms of agriculture, training, unemployment, youth, developing the infrastructure that must make it easy for the economy to grow? So I just want to know, because, I mean, as yourself, you must be doing that. And the other question is, are the managers of the fund Africans in particular and blacks in general? And how much bursaries is the fund contributing to the African students? Perhaps, I mean, as your own, you will have students coming to you and you just contribute here and there. So I thought maybe you cannot just go without answering for yourself this one. Next time, just don't come here. They should have come alone. So you just bring them here just to see that was it on.
Thanks, Honorable Lewis.
Yes, thank you. I'll try to keep my questions to the topic at hand. Were you aware at the time that this transaction was taking place. Were you aware at the time that this transaction was taking place? Or at what stage did you become aware of this transaction? Were you aware that the PIC was effectively overweight invested in Steinhoff beyond what the benchmark suggested they should be? And what did you do about that? And finally, what have been the consequences from the GEPF? In other words, what action has the GEPF taken against the PIC as your asset manager for the governance failures that took place there, which resulted in this transaction? Thank you.
Thanks. Honorable Kosa.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair, and my apology for arriving late. Well, I was just whispering to my colleague here, I think while PIC was answering questions, and I asked her as to whether has the GEPF presented already, and then she said no, it has not yet presented, it, and it doesn't seem like they are going to present. Maybe I think the arrangement itself, I think it was not a proper arrangement, because GEPF is the main structure which is responsible for the pension fund of our poor workers. Now, the PIC, like you indicated, is an asset manager acting on behalf of the GEPF. But when you go down to the poor workers on the ground, most of them, they don't even know the PIC, but they know the GEPF, that the GEPF is our pension fund. So I think it cannot happen that, well, I know, I understand the arrangement that we're talking about, but I don't think we must then remove the GEPF from the front line, because the GEPF must be in the front line. The PIC acts on behalf of the GEPF and reports to the GEPF. So the GEPF, I think, must understand all these things, the challenges that are faced by the PIC, successes and whatnot. And I think when you come here, if both GEPF and PIC appear before Parliament or before a parliamentary committee, my expectation would be that the GEPF would lead the presentation and says, this is where we are, and then from there hand over to the PIC to give the details, the other nitty-gritties, you see. But if the PIC takes over and do everything, then the GEPF will just say, no, ngele to lelo, whatever the PIC says, no, we agree. I think it would seem like the PIC has taken over, and I don't think it's a good thing. Perhaps in the future, I think if both the PIC and the GEPF, when they are supposed to come and appear before Parliament, I think the GEPF must lead, and then the PIC must come and complement what the GEPF has presented, because the GEPF is the main structure. So we must not take that away from the GEPF, so that it does not appear as if the PIC has taken over. So maybe the arrangement, I don't think it was a proper one. I think so. I'm pleading that in future let's correct it. Because if there are these kind of problems that are happening, people will say, no, it's happening because GEPF is not responsible. PIC, they're doing as they wish. So we must avoid creating that kind of an impression to the workers and to the public in general. We must show that GEPF is leading, GEPF is in charge, the PIC is acting on behalf of the GEPF. But now if they say there's that arrangement, therefore you can just come and observe, SPIC will do everything, it does not create a good picture. So I think it's something that we need to correct in future moving forward. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Honorable Skosan. The GEPF, can you respond?
Thank you, Chair. So the response to the first question is that no, we are not happy with PIC, and that is why we've set a limit of 2 billion on transactions. Above 2 billion, the PIC needs to come and request approval on that. And these are the transactions on the SIPS portfolio and on the unlisted side. And yes, we are keeping them accountable. PIC does report to us formally on a quarterly basis and as and when. And we also have formal meetings at ExCo to ExCo level, at an investment liaison committee level, and valuations committee level. So we are keeping them accountable, Chair. And the question regarding PIC being overweight, so in December, PIC was underweight at the time. And the question about Lancaster, we were not aware of the transaction when it happened at the time because the 2 billion limit was not in place. And we've heard your views regarding PIC coming to present and the arrangement, and we'll consider that in future. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. What we're emphasizing is that there should be oversight, starting with GEPF playing oversight on PIC. PIC has a lot of money that comes from GEPF that they are investing in JSE companies and in other ventures. And the same should apply within PIC. There should be a strong oversight by the accounting authority, which is the board, over management. Because it looks like at some stage management had more powers than the accounting authority. And that kind of a governance is problematic, where the the board just sees things happening. Then management takes big decisions which have got serious financial implications. Surely we don't believe that should be accepted, and it will be corrected, as Dr. Koza has indicated. So thanks very much, GPF and PIC. Before we close, do you have a question, Honorable Lewis? Which one?
I would just like to know what action you have taken or are taking against the PIC. What are the consequences?
If you don't mind, Chair, although I'm sitting at the front here, I actually have two hats. I've come as the chairman of the investment committee of the PIC, but I'm still a trustee of the GEPF. And unfortunately, the GEPF has a board meeting today. So I think they were ready on the 27th, but the board today clashed with their board meeting. So I think it's important for me to maybe take off my PIC hat and put on my GEPF hat now and just say, first of all, think in terms of the relationship between the two companies. Obviously, all of us are waiting for the outcome of the Mbati Commission. I think that's going to be very important. But secondly, the issue of accountability has been taken very seriously at the GEPF to the extent of reducing mandates drastically, and then other measures, of course, in the past. This is my first time in the structure, so whether I'm saying something which is wrong or not, I don't know. But I don't know if the committee, if the parliamentary structure, SCOF, would value perhaps a session in which GEPF and or PIC explained how the mandate works. So in particular, how a passive mandate works, where we seek to replicate the effect of the JSE in total, so that you effectively find yourself having to invest in all companies. And the effects of those kinds of decisions I think it's important, perhaps it might be important for the committee to understand that there are certain decisions which are taken because of a specific mandate that you've got and not because you choose to do a specific thing. And then we'll perhaps talk about the issue which has been raised about being overweight and underweight and so on and how that is regulated. So unless that's already been done, my sense is it would be quite useful to explain how a mandate is actually carried out, what it actually means on a daily basis or a quarterly basis and so on. Please forgive me if I'm suggesting something which is inappropriate, but if the committee would value that, then I think that that would be something that I think the PSC and the GPF should do.
Okay. Are you answered, Honorable Lewis?
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity to follow up again. I'm afraid not. I appreciate and understand perfectly well your mandate, sir. I just have a simple question. Has the GEPF taken any action to hold the PIC accountable, not for the listed portfolio, I understand the mandate and the benchmark, but for the Lancaster deal? And if so, what are the details of that accountability? Accountability doesn't just mean saying we're very concerned about this. It must involve consequences. So have you considered using other asset managers? Have you removed money from the PIC? I don't know. I'm thinking off the top of my head here. But what real accountability has the GEPF enforced against the PIC as a result of this governance failure?
Honorable Abrams, you are the last, so that we move to NetLec.
Yes, Chair. I think my question that I'm going to pose together with the Honorable Hugh Lewis can be answered in writing and further talked to in our next meeting, because I can imagine it's the kind of question that will be answered off the cuff and it does not need that. It's much deeper than that, because the question I have in my mind, for example, for GEPF is whether you do have some hope that the money will ever emerge. And if the response is to the negative, then what are you doing to prepare for that? What is your B option, kind of, when that does not happen? Because there is so much, I really feel for PIC, and I think they're working very hard. But as Honorable Mabileza would say, even as you respond to questions, there doesn't seem to be hope that you see the money coming. So I think our next interaction should be about realities as you see things happen. PwC not forthcoming, law enforcement taking their time, and everything on go slow, basically. So what are the realities? What is it? Maybe the question should be answered by both PIC and GEPF. What is the worst that we should expect under the circumstances? Because it is very difficult for people to talk about what can happen when it is not them who are going to be doing it. You look upon others, your law enforcement, your PwCs, etc., to execute what you are saying, because you do not have the power or the authority, but you depend on those. Sitting down as PIC and looking at your mandate regarding GPF, what is it that is possible, and what is it that is not possible? As I was saying, I don't want you to respond to that off the cuff. It could be, Chair, if you allow it, be a question for our next meeting.
Okay. Honorable Abrams, GPF.
The Honorable Member said, what actions have we taken?
None.
So there's been no legal actions, but there's been a lot of communication, and there have been reduced mandates, as I said before. There have been changes in delegations of authority. There have been lots of communication to the PIC about, for example, the issue which we mentioned at the beginning, that the CIO and the CEO was the same person. So there's been a huge amount of work that's gone on behind the scene. It's not as if the GPF is just sitting there and waiting for Mbati. We are waiting, of course, for the Mbati Commission, because a lot of information was given, and when that is revealed, we will then have in a much better position of what legal issues can proceed. In terms of the rights of the pension fund, a pension fund is responsible for the investment of its funds, and if the asset manager doesn't come to the party, the pension fund is in its rights to make sure that an appropriate person manages those funds. But this is why the mandate is important, because more than 80% of the fund is managed passively, so it wouldn't make any difference who was managing it. The results would be exactly the same. So the question then becomes, what do you do about the rest? So yes, that is an ongoing discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We'll meet in the new year. If you remember, we have given a task to PIC to report back to this committee in regard to some of the issues that have been raised by the Auditor General on some of the loans which the Auditor General has raised quite a number of issues, whether it's Tongati or Okaran Beef or whosoever. So we'll meet you in the new year to make a follow-up. If you remember, we met at where was it? At Mark's building. Yes. No. I think it was here. This bill, 120 plane, where we requested you to go and compile a report in regard to all the issues that the AG has raised, whether you have written off some loans and what are the reasons for writing off a loan. You have to give an explanation. So, GPF, next time Parliament invites you here and you have your board meetings and other meetings, we are not going to allow that. Parliamentary work takes precedence. There are three arms of government. It's legislature, executive, and judiciary. So we are not just calling you here because we have got nothing to do. We have got powers like the other two arms. So take Parliament very serious and not organize parallel meetings. And then the next thing, you can't take responsibility. I mean, it's untenable to have a situation where one board member present himself as PIC and then GPF. I think in the future that will not happen. We'll have the full board members of GPF speaking for GPF. So take Parliament very, very, very serious. As I told you, we have got even powers to subpoena. If invitation. So we'll be following the events very closely, the PwC report and the 31st December deadline as to what is it that you are going to do if mediation doesn't succeed. So thanks very much, GPF and PIC. We'll meet in the new year. Travel safely. Let's meet. Where's Nedlec? Hello? Let's have a 4 minute leg stretching or what do they call that break? Comfort. Yeah, let's have a comfort break. It's no longer called smoking. It's a break. Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Velikan. Okay, we are left with an hour. Welcome, Medlek. Last week, we had a meeting about the financial sector. We still have FSCA to present. Number three. Mr. Tebu, let me, so that I can manage time. Do you have FSCA? What's this item about, number three?
It's about the regulation.
It's Treasurer which is presenting. Who's presenting item three? Do we have Treasury here? Are you the one? Do you have an item on three, or is not? Is an information sharing session? No. Okay. I do this so that I'm able to manage time between now and 1 o'clock when we break. Netlek, we had a meeting last week in regard to financial sector transformation. Almost all the stakeholders that were expected were in that meeting. And that meeting didn't make progress, because the main stakeholder is Netlek. We issued an invitation to Netlek to come to last week's meeting. You accepted the invitation. Jika Jika, you are waiting for somebody to authorize the flight arrangement. The last Jika Jika is that it was a short notice. So, explain yourself why you didn't come to a meeting last week as invited by Parliament. And then you'll come to the presentation that you should have made last week. Netlek, your time is yours.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. My name is Temiwe Simkalipi. I'm the acting head of Netlek, and I'm accompanied by my colleague, Nobuntu Sibisi, and Vuyisa Thafu. And Chair, we must apologize for not being here last week. It was not because of our attempt to undermine the committee. The first time I started acting at Netlek on the 1st of October this year, and the first time I heard about the meeting, I was on a flight, getting out of flight from Cape Town last week, Monday, because I was here in Cape Town, that there was this meeting that I was supposed to attend the following day. And the time then was about 6 o'clock, because I took the 4 o'clock out of Cape Town. And I tried to find out what the meeting about, why, where is the notification, and I couldn't get proper information. And then I said to our guys, what options do we have to go to this meeting, make a presentation that is not well thought, or ask for a postponement so that we can make preparation and make the necessary investigation of what has happened. And I did the investigation to find out, and I got the email that says that we're invited on the 15th of November on this. I checked with our IT what has happened. And when we look at our IT, the people that the email that was sent to did not receive it. That's what the IT said. The email came, but it said pending. I'm assuming that what happened is that two of them, the email went to their junk mail instead of going to them, because they did not see it. One of them, it said the email also was received, but was never seen it. Therefore, when the colleagues agreed to come, when they were called on the meeting at that stage, I was not around. I didn't see what the presentation that we were going to give, and I was not comfortable in coming to give a presentation that we would not all look at it. And I suggested to them that they conduct parliamentary office and see whether can we postpone the issue. And we apologize for that. That's what has happened, Chair.
Okay. Next time, take parliament very, very seriously. We have been elected by the public to take care of their needs. So we are here on behalf of the public. We are not here on our own behalf. And Parliament is a very critical institution of the state. So next time when we invite you, there should be no stories of junk mails. And such a big institution like NEDLAG has got problem of junk mails. And no, that's an excuse. Have your office put together. We know there are challenges in NEDLAG, the CEO suspended, CFO suspended, CEO taking minister to court and all those. But NEDLAG is an institution. NEDLAG is not the CEO and the CFO. There's an institution called NEDLAG. So next time when we invite you, don't give us stories that it's a short notice and all those things. Starting with saying that there's nobody to approve the flight, the tickets, and then short notice. So we accept your apology. Then you can move to presentation.
My colleague Nobundu will do the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chairperson, and the honourable members of the committee. The presentation that I'm going to make is based on the progress that has been made at NEDLAG in relation to the engagements on the transformation of the financial sector. The first two slides of the presentation just talk to NEDLAG's mandate, that it is derived from the NEDLAG Act, the Labour Relations Act, the Founding Declaration, NEDLAG Constitution, NEDLAG Protocol, and above all, the Constitution of South Africa. And also, its legal mandate is to strive to promote the goals of economic growth through participation in economic decision-making, and also to seek to reach consensus and conclude agreements on issues that pertain to social and economic policy, to consider all proposed legislation in terms of labor legislation, and also to consider all significant changes to social and economic policy before implementation or introduced and before being introduced in Parliament, and to encourage and promote the formulation of a coordinated policy on social and economic matters, and lastly, to resolve socio-economic disputes in line with the Labour Relations Act, Section 77 of that Act. The committee may recall that NEDLAG convened the first financial sector summit in 2002, and then in 2016, NEDLAG saw a need to convene the second financial sector summit. And in preparations for that summit, there was a task team that was established by EXCO to undertake the preparations. During the consideration of this process by the task team, then it was identified that a research study as a basis for the financial sector summit should be conducted, which sought to assess progress that was made in relation to that summit. And then the findings of the research were presented and considered in the financial sector transformation workshop that was held last year in April, together with the consideration of the findings that came out of the report from the SCOF and the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. All those two documents were considered at the financial sector transformation workshop. In terms of the next slide, it just summarizes the outcomes from the 2002 summit, with the first one, which was to ensure access to basic financial services, jointly research the economics of basic financial services, development of sustainable institutions to serve poor communities, new enabling legislation for second and third tier deposit-taking financial institutions, proposals on ways to enhance the developmental impact of the regulatory framework, and to seek to support financial cooperatives and microcredit providers. And then the next slide continues with the agreements that were reached in the 2002 summit. In terms of proposing appropriate regulation for micro-lenders to minimize the negative effects of usurious practices. And then regulation of the credit bureau, elimination of discrimination, and also to end unfair discrimination against people with HIV and AIDS, capital markets and investment, and development finance institutions, and state-owned financial institutions, and saving initiatives. Those were the key issues around which there were supposed to be some actions emanating from the 2002 summit. However, upon the assessment of progress, it became clear that there was no data available that can indicate precisely to say how much progress has indeed been made, because there was limited monitoring of those agreements and there was limited assessment on the on follow-up and on implementation, and also there was no lack, I mean there was lack of consequences in terms of the implementation, or rather non-implementation of the resolution. So that those are the lessons that we've also learned from the summit. And then, as indicated earlier, a workshop was held in April 2018, which sought to propose and agree on recommendations and also to reach a declaration for considerations to be finalized at the second financial sector summit, which was expected to be convened in the same financial year. And as the committee may recall, there was a presentation at by NEDLAC in the last year, which was outlining what would ensue in terms of the NEDLAC processes for transformation in the financial sector, and part of those processes was the convening of the summit. However, Chair, the summit did not happen in the last financial year. And in respect of that, there was a decision that was taken by EXCO after having considered a number of things, namely that there were two summits that have been convened in that financial year, and some of the issues were cross-cutting between the, for example, the job summit and the financial sector summit. And also, most importantly, Chair, was the issue of coming out of those workshops. There were four themes that we considered in the next session. The workshop considered the four themes that were also emanating or derived from the SCOF report, which related to market concentration, monopolization, ownership and licensing, and the support for emerging enterprise and black businesses through procurement and supplier development, the role of DFIs and state-owned entities in transformation of the financial sector, and the role of financial sector transformation council and regulatory bodies. So in terms of the workshop, before I get to the expatiating on the reasons for not convening the summit, let me just finish this slide. But in terms of the workshop which happened, there was a obviously, as mentioned earlier, the workshop welcomes the SCOF report and the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry's first report and the transformation of the sector, and the recommendations contained in that report were considered at length. And the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee was also one of the participants at that session. And then the workshop agreed with most issues that were concerned and on, were recommended on the report, except that there was one area that could not be finalized, which related to the panel system that is used by the insurance companies. However, for that particular issue and other issues that is still needed to be threshed out at length, because that one day, 2 day session was very short, it was then agreed to say there should be more work that's done at NEDLAG through the working committees. So the four working committees operating under these themes were established so that they can thresh out those issues. And having threshed those issues out, there was a report that was developed, which was submitted to EXCO in February this year, and also there was a declaration that was signed off by all social partners highlighting and outlining various areas of agreement and the way forward coming out of those engagement processes. And now coming to that part that relates to the convening of the summit is that EXCO considered a number of things, one being the convening of the other summits that were convened in the last financial year, and also the work that was done by these four working committees to say all the work that would have been dealt with at the summit, it was dealt with at length through the working committees. And now to having to convene the summit and also considering the financial implications seemed not to be a necessity at that stage. Instead, it was then agreed that EXCO would consider that report, sign off, and then the report would be submitted to various stakeholders, including the Standing Committee on Finance, as well as the various departments. So in terms of the agreement, Chair, that we made from the committee, the presentation outlines them per each theme. And in terms of the market concentration, the following areas were agreed by social partners, that the monitoring of the implementation of the financial education to ensure access to funding for new entrants in the financial sector in order to facilitate growth and development in the emerging enterprises, to address and eradicate barriers to entry and anti-competitive conduct in the financial sector through amending, repealing any legislation, regulations, or directives that inhibit the transformation in the financial sector. One of the areas that was even highlighted here was the amendment of the competition bill, and I must also mention that the competition amendment bill is currently being considered at NEDLAG. To play a role in ensuring that large financial institutions at all levels reflect the demographics of the country in the level of ownership, control, and management. To revise and amend relevant legislation so that they are consistent with the objectives and goals of transformation of the financial sector, and to facilitate and ensure compliance with the financial sector code. And then in relation to the support for SMMEs and black-owned businesses, the following areas were agreed: that there was a need to engage on the low participation or exclusion of previously disadvantaged service providers in the supply chain within the entire financial sector. And in doing so, there was a need to look into the exclusion of financial services advisors from the developmental targets and other agreements within the insurance industry, and to review empowerment, financing targets, and to give more weight to funding black SMMEs, rural and township entrepreneurs. So if I can just maybe mention one of the areas which was agreed in relation to this is to investigate the targets of about a limit of 1,000 rand, which is kept for the empowerment of black financial advisors. So that was one of the discussions to say this needs to be investigated further, because if you are to empower someone, 1,000 rand is not enough for the whole year to be spent just for empowerment. And also to review procurement laws such as the Public Finance Management Act, Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, and the Municipal Finance Management Act in order to review the transformation objectives, to review empowerment financing targets to give more weight to funding of black SMMEs, rural and township entrepreneurs, and provide SMMEs and black-owned entities which have the potential of creating jobs with grants, basically provide grants to those, and also equity funding, and to provide them with loans that have preferential interest rates. In relation to the role of the DFIs, the social partners agreed that there was a need to identify hurdles in relation to the licensing of the Post Bank to become a state-owned enterprise or state-owned bank, so as to provide affordable banking services and expand financial inclusion in the neglected areas, in the rural areas and townships. Review the governance, mandates, and structures of the DFIs, and consider realigning and consolidation, and set targets in line with national imperatives, such as job creation, and to ensure the availability of appropriate funding mechanisms for DFIs so that they can be able to execute their mandate, and to ensure that the DFIs report on the transformation, on their transformation initiative to the Financial Sector Transformation Council and to the BEE Commission. And the last theme in terms of that working committee was on the role of Financial Sector Charter Council and regulatory bodies. Then there was an agreement reached by social partners for a need to review the Financial Sector Code implementation guidelines to ensure relevance and ease of implementation, to review and expand the power of the council so as to be able to ensure punitive action is taken for non-compliance with the Financial Sector Code and for lack of timeous and accurate reporting of information from the financial institutions. Because during the engagement, it became clear that the council did not have the information that is reported timeously to be able to account to say how much has been done. So this was to enable it to this review would be able to give it some peace, if I can put it that way. And then the need of clearly defining roles of other regulatory bodies in supporting the council in driving transformation. And in conclusion, Chair, it is important to note that the commitment that is displayed by social partners during engagement is indeed appreciated. However, there is now a need for those agreements to be implemented. It is very imperative that the agreements are reached and are implemented to ensure that the envisioned transformation of the sector is realized. And in this regard, the Financial Sector Transformation Council is expected to report to NEDLAC annually on progress made in relation to the implementation of the agreements. Because most of those agreements, the council would be the implementing partner. well, together with social partners as well. And then lastly, as NEDLAG, we will continue to engage with various stakeholders towards advancing transformation in the financial sector. And Chair, once again, we must thank you for giving us the opportunity to present, having missed our opportunity last week. We do appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Honourable members, questions, comments. When is the summit? Was last week the concluding agreement is that there should be a summit, and the summit can only be convened by NEDLAG. Members, questions, comments? Honorable Abrams? Honorable Mavile, are you raising it? Honorable Mavile? Fighter Rebecca, are you raising your hand? Okay. Honorable Abram.
Yes, sir. Thanks so much. The presentation is appreciated. However, Chair, I think we need some elaboration on the status quo in NEDLAG. What is happening there? Why does such a huge institution, such a huge responsibility, have such weaknesses as communication, email, trivial excuses for not attending national programs? If we can get an indication on the state of governance, we hear that here we have an acting chairperson. So if we could get an indication of who else is acting, what else is happening, and what is the consequence of that acting in that institution. Secondly, Chair, there have been resolutions taken over time, including from 2002 and as well as last year. And the issues, I think, that have been resolved in the various summits have to do with the discussions that we held last week with institutions that were here and institutions that would that were not in a position to give us answers as to the progress on transformation in the country. But these are issues that are listed here, like the posture of the credit bureau, which is one of the fundamental things that bar ordinary people from getting access to finances. If, for example, a group of young people, Honorable Mabileza raised a question in the meeting about a group of young people who needed to access finances for their corporation, and one of them owed 100 rands to the credit bureau. And this could be explained as the young person having had an opportunity to serve as an intern, and in that period they had some credits, and then they used them and owed, as a result, 100 rands, and the contract came to an end. And because of that one young person, the entire group was punished. So how are we to find out what the progress is on such matters? How does NEDLAC assist us? I will not ask the question that the chairperson has already asked. I take it that you have already noted that. How, for instance, is NEDLAC ensuring that indeed discrimination is eliminated? Because there's a lot of discrimination in our big banks in the country. And how then do we get assistance so that we can indeed, some members in in the meeting last week were saying we must just close shop, there will never be transformation in South Africa. And for me, I think you need to answer us on that as to whether ultimately we will get to a point in our country where we have real transformation, which transformation is a result of everybody having equal access to financing when they want to start a business. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Bul Mavirat.
Thank you, Chair. I must just start by saying not coming last week didn't make you to look good. So now we are still here, we're still here, we are here. So next time when you are called, even if I don't know when, just go there and, I mean, your presentation today, it's fine. We understand your mandate, we understand your issues. So please don't stay away next time. It looks like you are delinquent. You know, when you are called, and I just said to myself, ah, they didn't do their work, you know, it's not right. So I just want to find out, all labor organizations are affiliated to you, all of them. If not, why, where are the others? Then what are you doing to make sure that they are affiliated? And the other question about access to funding, you know, there is this other group that is in the middle in terms of buying a house. They cannot buy a house because of the level of the scale of funding where they are. And they cannot even access the RDP. And at the same time, going to the flat, they are able to pay perhaps above 5,000. But that same person also can qualify to buy a car. And they can get an access to buy a car for, you know, a very expensive car. You know the group that I'm talking about. So when we are talking about access to funding, why is it that they continue to be frustrated? At the same time, a person is able to buy, to drive a 1 million car, but they cannot buy a house of 500,000, and they cannot get an RDP. And we leave them, we know with them at home. So what are you doing about, maybe you have discussed them at the summit, I don't know. If not, what is it that you are doing about it? So in terms of labor, if the labor organization are affiliated to you, I'm still worried about labor brokering. What is it, labor brokering? You know, just to hire, you know, our young people, even older people, through this labor brokering. What are you saying about it? Did you discuss it at the summit? If not, why? Where is it going to end? Because it must come to an end. And I had a couple of things, but I have a feeling that maybe perhaps some of the things we can discuss them to the summit. And I also had a feeling that there was also a decision of saying maybe the summit, you shouldn't do the summit. I didn't hear you very well when you presented. So where is the summit? Are we still going to have that summit? Because for us that are new, then these other things will be able to discuss them there at the summit. Because now I think, if I'm asking you the other group last week, because I can see the correlation between you and the others. They were blaming you with some of the things, but I see some of the things that I prepared, they could have answered them. Okay, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Buskosa.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, we welcome the presentation from NEDLAC. I see that you I think you indicated your mandate in the presentation, and you further indicated that there was a summit in 2002, and that in 2016 you saw a need to convene another summit, and that there was a task team that was put in place to prepare for it, and that in 2018 there was a sector transformation workshop, financial sector transformation workshop, and I think you went further, I think, to list things that were agreed upon in that particular workshop. What I would have expected from the presentation, because I think what we are more interested on is the issue of the transformation of the financial sector. We're more interested in knowing that, in knowing as to whether are we winning the battle of transforming the financial sector. I was expecting to hear from the presentation to say, since the existence of NetLink, since NetLink came into existence, how far have we moved in transforming the financial sector for it to be able to serve all South Africans. But I see that we only chose to talk more about the workshop that was held in 2018 April and the agreements thereof in that particular workshop. I think for a person who was not in the workshop and who is not familiar with your achievements as NetLink for over the years, won't be able to know as to whether are we moving to the correct direction, are we having some challenges, wherein assistance is needed perhaps from Parliament or something. I think that's what I was expecting. I don't know whether I was expecting too much from you. I think that's what I was expecting, because our interest, even in the last week's meeting that my colleagues are referring to, our interest is on the transformation of the financial sector, because we want to know as to whether we're making any impact, any movement. So when we make other inputs, but we make inputs on the basis of an informed position, say, since on the past 20 years or past 10 years we have moved thus far, so for us to move forward, what is it that is needed to be done? So I think those things, they don't come clearly from your presentation. So I think that's what we, I think, from my side, that's what I would have expected from the presentation. Thanks, Honourable Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Robert Shan.
Thanks, Chair. Let me start by saying that the financial sector is one of the most important sectors in South Africa. The economy and includes banks, the insurance companies, and investment funds. So, if we overlook all those sectors, we will not be able to transform the financial, the economy. The BEE charter has tried to make black inclusion, but it did not happen. The reason being that let me say that I think as the committee, we will need to initiate a legislation to be passed by Parliament in order to, that will prescribe that all legal businesses in South Africa must be a minimum of 50% owned by black people, or the state and content of such ownership must not be to be black male elites only, but it must also, the woman must also be part of the ownership. Chairperson, let me also say that we are having a lot of businesses in South Africa that are controlled by the minorities, and us as the majorities, we don't have that access. So I think it is with NetLink to ensure that the transformation happens. Let's go to insurance companies. Majority of the insurance company, if you can ask, they are led, they are controlled. The owners are white people, and they are in charge. us as the black people, we don't have, we don't even have access, more particularly women, to have the licenses for the insurance companies. The other thing that make us that make it difficult for you to transform is the issue of this National Credit Act that need to be reviewed as well. You will find a situation where a person buy a house. Most especially, we are affected as black people because historically we've been having a problem in terms of wealth. So you'll find somebody have bought a house, and then along the way, that person failed to pay that house. And the government does not even give try to assist that person. For in case you have paid the 50% of the money that you owed, they will repossess your house. This thing causes trauma in our people and all those things. So if we really want to transform the economy, let's start there and review what we call the National Credit Act. Chairperson, when you bought a house, when you are buying a house, there is what we call the home insurance. Normally, the home insurance is bundled with the mortgage payment. But failure for you to pay the mortgage payment, the insurance amount also gets forfeited. Why is the government not making sure that when you fail to pay your house, but you were failing to you were also paying the house with the insurance, why they don't pay you the money that you paid into the insurance? Into the insurance. And then the other last thing that I want to touch is presenting, you talked about that there's a problem with regards to licensing of the post bank. What are the hurdles? Why are we failing to transform post bank into a state-owned bank so that it can provide affordable banking services for the poor? Why? What is the problem? And then I also want to know, there was a bank called African Bank. Where is African Bank now? Why is the government not ensuring that maybe it restructure the African Bank into the state-owned bank as well? What also failed the state to start banks like retail-owned bank, agricultural state-owned bank, and housing state-owned bank, social assistance bank? I understand it's the work of the Parliament to issue all those things. I mean, to initiate all those things for you to do your work. But I think going forward as a committee, we need to try by all means to lobby Parliament in terms of these things. I'm lobbying this committee, and the committee must make sure that we take this thing forward to Parliament to legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. If you can respond in 5 minutes, because we are left with 16 minutes before 1, and members have to leave and prepare for this afternoon session. So find a way of summarizing so that we can take the last presentation of pleasure. Nedless.
Thank you, Chair. I think the most important thing that we need to say is that NEDLAC decision, the responsibility of the social partner. When we make commitments, if social partners are not committed, some of those commitments that were made in the financial in the charter must be implemented by government, some must be implemented by business, some must be implemented by other social partners. And there's no doubt that the carry over and the implementation of the commitments that are made, there is a challenge at NEDLAC and with our social partners. And that's the issue that maybe the next summit need to deal with, to look at what is it that we've agreed at, why was not implemented going forward. The Chair has asked when is the next summit. And that a date has not been set on that. There's a debate within NEDLAC on whether to have it this year, because we're going to have another Work on Africa Job Summit this year. There's going to be another investment summit held by the president again this year. Are these issues not interlinked in terms of the issues that are being put on? Those are the issues that we need to look at and prepare for them. But that discussion is taking on in order to, if we are going to have it next year, we put in our plan now so that we can have the resources ready for it. The issue of the governance of NEDLAC, the chair is correct, this is the problem that we're trying to sort out to make sure that NEDLAC operates properly. We've had interviews for filling the permanent post of the director. The CFO's post has also been interviewed, filled. We hope by the 1st of January the CFO will be starting a permanent CFO so that we don't have this governance issue that we have within the organization. The issue about whether all federations part of the NEDLAC process, members would know that FEDUSA, NAGTU, and COSATU make up NEDLAC, and SAFTU did apply to be part of NEDLAC. That application process is still in the process with them, in discussion with them in terms of the information that they need to supply so that that decision needs to be made. Now, the issue of labor broking, members would know, understand, and remember that the Labor Relations Act regulates, deal with the issue of labor broking, but not banning it. And the new Labor Relations Act, which was passed by Parliament, in the 5th Parliament, is dealing with this issue. Whether it's dealing with it effectively, as members would like, that's another issue, but the Labor Relations Act deals with that issue. Now, on the issues of the post bank, the issue of African bank, and all of those issues, I've said decisions taken at NEDLAC in terms of this framework are implemented by other government departments. And as I mean, members would know that the Reserve Bank, the Department of Treasury, are busy with the issue of licensing of the post bank to ensure that the post bank is licensed, is able to operate as a bank within the very short space of time. Therefore, some of these decisions, as I've said, that were taken in the last summit are being processed. It's taking a little bit longer. The procurement bill that Treasury is busy dealing with presently was one of the issues that came up in the summit. But the issue is the time it takes for us to put through all the decisions that we've taken. I'm trying to have 5 minutes, Chair, in dealing with all the issues and summarize them.
Sir, the issue of the summit is not the issue of the committee. There's the 2017 report. I think you have that report, where there was a financial sector meeting and convened by SCOF and Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee. They presented the report to National Assembly. It was adopted. And a key amongst other resolutions is that there should be a summit. So we are asking you these questions in relation to what has been resolved before. So we are not starting a new process. Our basis is the report that was adopted by the stakeholders, then by Parliament. So the investment summit is something else, Yaga President. We are not into investment summit. We are into transformation. Investment to attract investors. Parliament can't hold an investment summit because otherwise we'll be entering into the space of the executive. Ours is summit that have to deal with oversight and make sure that decisions taken by Parliament get implemented. So we don't initiate other summit, and we don't hold the convene the summit ourselves, as there is NEDLAC, which is responsible. So go and look at that matter and come back to us as soon as possible. We'll write to you to make a follow-up as to when are we having a summit to deal with financial sector transformation. of every stakeholder which was in last week's meeting was saying there's nothing much that we can do if NEDLAC is not on board. We can go up to SOFA, but beyond here, no. The BEE, triple BEE commission, the financial sector council, the Reserve Bank was there, and there's another one, another group that, body that presented. It will come to my mind. The, all those which are key were there. Yeah, and treasure also presented. So let's look at this issue of the summit. It was Tina. As this committee, we have the responsibility to make sure that resolutions get implemented. Thanks very much. You will be in touch with the committee secretariat. Quickly, so that we get treasure.
While you are speaking, I'm just laughing because I'm looking at them. While you were presenting, I had a feeling that, you know, there are the questions that we have, that your partners must answer them. There is not much that you can do, as you have stated. So I'm just laughing is that you got us where you wanted. Because maybe you discuss with them, or Rena will not come, Lena goes there. It's like, you know, we did nothing. I come on.
Okay. No. We'll hold them. I even spoke to the minister on what day did we have that meeting? Was it Wednesday or Thursday? Yes, I spoke to Minister Nice when you didn't come. I went to him in the chamber and told the minister that, Minister, NEDLAC doesn't take Parliament very seriously. So instead, we'll call you to come and explain to the committee. So that's when he told me about the challenges of governance. But he's attending to them. So we have elevated this matter to the level of the minister. I spoke to him. So come back to us, please. Thanks very much. Let's get to the last item, which we told you to be 5 minutes. Discussions on the proposed joint standard on margin requirements for non-centrally cleared over-the-counter derivative transactions made in terms of Section 107 of the Financial Sector Regulations Act 9 of 2017, with all those sections and subsections mentioned there. Is it Treasury that's presenting, or is FSCA who's presenting?
Chair, we've got the Treasury, we've got a representative from the Prudential Authority of the Reserve Bank, Lara Horsley, and then Rhea Thunder, who's legal advisor at the FSCA. So, Chair, just to quickly say that what happened during the Twin Peaks process, when we the Financial Sector Regulation Act, is the committee felt at the time that all subordinate legislation must come to this committee for consideration if necessary. And when we say subordinate legislation, we mean the rules that are made under the law and so forth. So I'm going to skip the first few slides because that just gives you background, but go directly to slide 5 in the interest of time. We can put it up also, or if it's okay, we can just go from the presentation. So basically, the Act requires all the subordinate legislation must be formally tabled in Parliament. These are generally highly technical areas of financial sector regulation, financial sector requirements. For example, it's like the calculation of how much capital a bank needs to hold. So technical calculation type things that we submit. The standards or the subordinate legislation may not exceed the ambit of the Act. They must be consistent with the objectives of the Act, and they must be made in terms of an empowering provision of the Act. But most importantly, the Standing Committee felt during the process when we passed the Act that there must be a clear and transparent process for making of the requirements. So affected parties must be consulted in a meaningful way. Parliament is given a formal role, so we submit the standards to Parliament. But importantly, because of the sheer volume of requirements, Parliament does not need to approve. So all that we require from Parliament is to consider. If you think that there are major issues that you would like us to deal with, we can have hearings, considerations, for example, but there is no formal requirement for Parliament to actually approve this. And this is because Parliament has already approved the main piece of legislation that gives effect to the Twin Peak system. And so these small things which relate to calculations of capital, for example, in this case, calculation of the amount of margin that needs to be held, do not need to be formally approved by Parliament. So we've been engaged in a very long process of consultation with industry, probably 2 years or more even. Since at least 2015, we've put out drafts of these standards. We've had workshops with industry. We have issued drafts, and we issued a formal last bit of drafts during the course of last year, and that was out for a period of public comment. We got formal feedback on all the comments. These comments have all been posted on our website, and basically this is the last period where we formally consult Parliament and we ask if Parliament would like to make any inputs to the process. We can go through a formal discussion on each component of the process, but I might also ask Advocate Jenkins to explain exactly what the law means when it said consideration, because I think that was one of the issues that came up during the process of passing the Twin Peaks legislation. Just that the committee is completely aware of what your legal requirements are in terms of this process.
Okay. Was Advocate Jenkins? Yeah, can you come in and explain what he has raised here, more especially whether Parliament has to approve or not to approve? Let's make it very simple for us to understand.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good afternoon, honourable members, Chair, colleagues. It's correctly the introduction, if I may call it that, that my colleague from Treasury, Roy, has given to the committee is 100% correct. Well, I would say what is inside these joint standards and others might be just detailed, too detailed. But in any event, Chair, what I'm saying is it might not be small matters. There might be people who feel that this is quite substantive, and I think even these ones, they're talking about margins of 30 billion and so on, I think, in terms of trading of these over-the-counter derivatives. But nevertheless, what we did when we passed this legislation, when it comes to these, what we would call complicated subordinate legislation, and I think the DDG, Mr. Mumia, at the time said some of these standards that they make is quite voluminous. So it is impractical for Parliament to approve them, and therefore we delegated that to the various authorities that's established in terms of the Financial Sector Regulation Act. But what we did in that act is that we have created a system where Parliament can have proper oversight over the process of making this subordinate legislation, standards, regulations. There's a whole lot, whole list of these in the definitions of the Financial Sector Regulation Act. So there's, first of all, a process that's prescribed, in this case the joint standards, which National Treasury needs to follow. There's a process prior to making the standard. It's set up in, I think it's Section 98 of the Act, which says you must publish a draft and you must have an explanation of the need for this and the statement of the expected impact, and then a notice inviting submissions. It's in the pack that has been handed out to members. It's one of the thinner documents. It's a statement. And after that, they can make the standard. But that standard must then be sent to Parliament, as Roy indicated formally. I'm just looking for the words. 90 agencies must be submitted, and in terms of section 103, it says we must submit it to Parliament for a period of at least 30 days while Parliament is in session. Now, Chair, that's the context of the Act. When this is then referred to the Speaker and to the Chairperson, because it must go to both houses, and it may go to both houses at the same time. This is then referred to the various committees, the Standing and the Select Committee on Finance. And what's important is then to see what is the entry within the ATC. And the entry for these is usually just it's a referral for consideration, and I think that is what Roy is referring to. And that means we can make input as a committee. Doesn't mean you have to report to the House on it, and the House must make the input. The committee itself can make that input. Simply put, Parliament, even if it is in the Houses, we cannot approve or reject the standards that are being made by the various stakeholders in the FSC, in the Financial Sector Regulation Act. For that, we'll have to amend the Act, because the power really lies with the various bodies that makes it. All we need to do as a committee and as a House is to oversee the process and see that the process is in compliance with the Act. And of course, if there's non-compliance, we can point that out, but I'm sure there will be stakeholders that would challenge those regulations if it doesn't suit them well. So the task here, simply put, Chair, is the committee can consider. It does not have to report to the House. It can make input. It can also listen to other stakeholders that have come forward. And just to oversee the process, what one can envisage happening is to say, look, there's some unhappiness because of the process that you followed. They are supposed to submit a report on the consultation process. It's quite a voluminous report. It has been submitted here. From this, I mean, this is the first, I think, or the second time that we had at the end of last year as well, so it's the second time that we're having these standards coming to us now, but there's about three or four in the pipeline that's already been submitted to Parliament. I think it's about three, if I'm not mistaken. So it's still a process that's unfolding, and if Parliament wants to make, or the committee wants to make, suggestions to Treasury or to the FF, the financial sector bodies that are making these standards, we can. We can say the consultation process needs to be more in-depth or why their process and so forth. But that is it, Chair. Maybe you must put it to this way, in seeing that it is the end of the year. Once Treasury have submitted all the documents to us, the report on the consultation process, we have seen the notice that they've made in terms of Section 98, and then the standards itself, it's here and everything has been followed. We have 30 days to make an input, and thereafter the various bodies can bring it into operation. The Minister can bring those regulations in operation. For us to stop that or to have more of an effective input on it, we'll have to change the Act, but I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just saying that for what the committee must do is we just have to see the making of these regulations, in short. That's it, Chair.
Okay, I forget Jenkins does that. So, what is it concretely that you suggest? Because it seems like there's no need for this report to be taken to Parliament. To have a, we just acknowledge here that they present it and they go and implement the standards. Do we have to take a resolution as a committee, or is it just for nothing? So let's be clear whether it has to be a resolution or it's for nothing.
It's for nothing. So I would suggest, if one wants to pay attention to it in terms of a process, we have the documents. So political parties can look at the documents. Obviously, they have constituencies that might give input to them. If there's a need, then any member in the committee can say to or suggest to the chair, let's look in more detail at some of these joint standards that are in front of us. Consider them and have an engagement with National Treasury. But failing that, or if it's not necessary, I mean, we can just note it as a committee. We can see that it's here, members can look at it, give it to your researchers, see if there's any problems with it, and we have time to make input. committee notes it, and if the committee feels like it can actually make a report to the House, but obviously at this time of the year it's not going to be considered by the House, and the House in fact doesn't have to consider that report because there's no decision that must be taken. It's something that will be referred to National Treasury. So it's just really for noting, Chair. There's no need for a resolution or a motion to be moved in the committee itself.
Sorry, Chair, just to add. So obviously the process was ACC'd, I think, on the 27th of November or something. So it will still be, you can still consider it in the new year. There will still be some period in the new year. So if any political parties or any of the constituencies want to spend some time over the next 2 months before February to go back, we're perfectly happy to wait. There's no rush on our side. So we don't have to deal with it all today or in the next week. We can certainly take inputs next year, if that would help.
Any question, members? Because now we are eating into your lunch. And it's like today we'll have a long session. Tomorrow we start at 10, Honorable Rebecca.
So, Chair, are they saying the 30 days period fall away? It's going to fall now because he said in 30 days we must put our comments. So the gentleman there said it can be next year, it's okay. Is it like that?
Advocate Jenkins, quickly, so the members can be ready for lunch.
And the 30 days will exclude the days when Parliament is not in session. Or let me put it that the 30 days actually will not exclude it, but it will exclude Saturdays, Sundays, and public holidays, because it will be in terms of the Interpretation Act. It's not when Parliament is in session or not. That's not going to count. So that's where we are. So one can work out exactly when. But, Chair, the input that one can give on these standards, even after they've come into effect, one can do that. And one can then ask Treasury to respond to that, whether they need to change it. What one usually sees with these things, because of their complexity in them, is that stakeholders, in this instance banks, and traders in over-the-counter derivatives will come forward and say this doesn't work for us in practice. Or as those dates in the standards come closer, I think it's it's sort of second semester next year, and then various dates or various issues come forward. I just quickly looked at them. You might find stakeholders coming to yourself, Chair, saying, well, we're not happy with how these standards are going to impact on us. And one can have a meeting on that then and say, look, we must make it practical. This is about growth. This is about financial growth. So one can then have that engagement. The 30-day period that we are in now is basically just to have that intense oversight if it's necessary, to say, let's look at it before we bring it into operation. But as I understand, they will only come into operation, I think, October next year or something like that. So there's time, Chair, to look at it, to see will it work and how is it going to work. It's important to notice, Chair, that this is it's not something that I'm an expert on. Let me just put that. But the over-the-counter derivatives is quite a complicated way of trading interest or stock. So there will be complications, and there will be time, actually, to deal with it and to look further into it. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. I think we can defer the matter to February, where we'll get a full briefing, because now money is not only withdrawn through the counter. In the era of cyber, how do you deal with that? Because there's a lot of money that goes around through cell phone and internet and all those. So let's defer this matter until after SONA is on the 13th of February. Then debate the following week. Then committees start. So, Alan, you look at the date when we can come back and get a full briefing so that we have a better understanding of what is contained in this document. So, honorable members, the meeting is adjourned.